Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Hello and welcome to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope that you are having a wonderful second day of summer. Yesterday we celebrated the summer solstice and it was so beautiful. I went to an event last night with Surya. Well, she was performing and it was just so amazing. It was a fundraising event for Tibet and also a celebration of the summer solstice, and beautiful musicians played, and a Buddhist teacher did a blessing and for all of our wishes, and oh, it was just so magical and uplifting and wonderful. And I had a fantastic first day of summer, so I hope that you also had a fantastic first day of summer. And today's guest is Janine Roth. Now, she is the author of the book Lost and Found, and she normally writes about food issues and how we can become addicted to food and these patterns of deprivation and binging and purging and all of that. And Janine had an experience where she had about, I believe, $1 million in investments, and it was all invested with Bernie Madoff. Like, all of her money, 100% just about of her money was invested with Madoff. And then, of course, he turned out to be a complete fraud, and she lost everything, and she was able to realize that she thought she'd healed herself from her issues with food, but the way she was treating money was exactly the same kind of pattern with her addiction with food, with the deprivation and the spending and the splurging and then feeling guilty about it. So we're going to talk with her about that, but I'm waiting for her to call in today, so I'm going to play a song in the meantime, and hopefully Janine will be connected very soon. So I'm going to play a song by the lovely Surya, who I saw in concert last night. She is also the songs I'm going to play right now are not on her album, her fundraising album, but if you are interested and you like her sound and her music, I would encourage you to go to iTunes and look up Songs of the Buddha, because she has created this fundraising CD for Tibet charities, and you can get it on iTunes. It's called Songs of the Buddha. And it looks like we have a caller on the line, so let's just see. Is this Janine?
Uh-huh.
Hi, Janine. How are you?
Good, good.
So I'll play that song at the end of the show, since I just mentioned it. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. So I was just doing an introduction about your book and how you thought you'd healed your issues with food and the binging and purging and all of that, and then when you lost all your money, you realized that you really hadn't cleared those issues at all. You still had them going on with money.
Well, I wouldn't say that I hadn't cleared the issue. Completely accurate. I would say that in terms of my relationship with food, they were absolutely clear. Food is not a problem for me anymore, which is in itself a miracle, since I spent so many years binging and losing and gaining and being anguished, sort of living in hell, really, about my relationship with food. So on the most external level with food itself, the issues are clarified and non-existent. On the level of abundance, deprivation, what it means to have, allowing myself to take in, being present to all that's here. Those are the issues that I realized were not really clarified all the way through when the financial hoopla happened.
So let's get a bit of a summary now. You had invested pretty much all of your money with Bernie Madoff. What did you discover about yourself when you lost the money? Why everyone who hears about finances and investing says, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So why did you?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question? You know, I'm going to back into this a little bit and say that what I've discovered about money, about myself and money, and as I've traveled around the country talking to people about money, is that there seems to be a sort of a Harry Potter invisible cloak around the issues of money. There's secrecy, there's shame, there's guilt, and there's a split in terms of spirituality. And that is that spiritual people don't think about, talk about money, don't want to make money, aren't supposed to have money. There's a whole underworld of beliefs that we have about money that most of us have never looked at. Mm-hmm. I would say that from the single mother who I interviewed, who was scraping to get by month to month, to people who had $1 million or more, it cut across the same consciousness line, which is it's difficult to think about, it's complex to think about, I'd rather not, I'd like somebody else to take care of it. The beliefs that I have that I'm carrying into this relationship with money that really don't have much to do with money, but nonetheless are laminated onto money, all of that is included in our relationship to money. And what I realized, and this is getting back to your question about how come you put it all in one basket, even though everybody says to diversify, the answer is because I was unconscious about money. I didn't want to think about it. And because I had a friend who I trusted and loved very, very much, whose father had known Bernie Madoff, who had been invested with Madoff for two generations, more than 30 years, who had done well enough, not with the same numbers. Apparently, it turns out that Bernie Madoff gave different returns to different people. So some people he gave 150% on their money, some people he gave 5% on their money. We were in the 5 and 6% realm. But it didn't matter because I knew Richard, I trusted Richard, and I didn't want to think about it. It was fraught with guilt and shame. And so it was just easier to give it to somebody else to deal with.
So, Janine, bringing it back to the similarities of issues with food, is that kind of the same idea as people who just like eat everything out of a can and they don't want to think about preparing it?
No, it's not. It's not an analogy like that. I would say that the analogy is that we use both food and money as ways to go unconscious. You know, what I say is obsession is a way to change the channel on what's going on in your mind when you don't like it or you're uncomfortable. And so both food and money are used in that way. They're used as distractions. They're substances, external substances. Money, in many ways, is a concept, really. I mean, it's a tangible thing. I mean, we get stuff for money. Food is a little different in that way. But nonetheless, we use both of them as ways not to be present, not to be conscious, not to to feel our own discomfort, not to question places we've never questioned. You know, I could be feeling bored or lonely or sad, and I'll turn to food. I could be feeling bored or lonely or sad, and I'll go buy something, a gadget, a thing, and that will temporarily distract me.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them sort of come out of what I call a trance of deficiency
mm-hmm.
that many of us feel. We take ourselves to be deficient. I'm not enough. I don't value myself. I don't even know who I am. I'm not in touch with myself. And so food and money both are temporary and external sources of stimulation. They pick us up for a moment, take us out of that trance for a moment. They pierce the trance because then we're excited, but how we use them comes directly from being entranced into feeling like we're not enough.
And so, Janine, why do you think so many of us, and I'm sure it's not every person, but so many people feel like they don't have enough? They don't have enough food. They don't have enough money. They don't have enough. They just need more, more, more. Why is that?
I think it's not about out there. I think it's about in here. I think enough is not a quantity. It's not in something you can touch or buy or have. After, and there have been many studies that have shown this, after the first $50,000, after you have enough money, and I know that many people don't have enough money for this, but let's say you do have enough money for food and shelter, for basic comfort. Let's just say you do have enough for that. After that initial amount, there have been endless studies that have shown that having more does not make people happy.
Mm-hmm.
The correlate between happiness and money is non-existent. And the correlate between being thin and being happy is also non-existent. What I also say is that if being thin could make people happy, then all thin people would be happy. Every single thin person would be happy in the world. And we know that's not true. And if being rich made people happy, if having money made people happy, every rich person would be happy. We also know that that's not true. So enough is a roving quantity. I mean, we think it's out there, but it has nothing to do with out there once, as I said, the basic necessities and comforts are dealt with. The same with food, of course, you know, if you have enough food to eat and to live. But there's a sense of who we are isn't enough. Who I am isn't enough. And so something out there, getting something out there, will fix something in here. And so there's that endless thirst and endless hunger for more and more and more and more and more and more and more to fix something that actually can't be fixed by out there.
And so, Janine, I hear what you're saying about once you have enough, there's a threshold of, you know, having your basic needs met, which everyone needs to feel like they have their needs met. But beyond that, you don't need the latest iPad and the flat-screen TV and the new BMW and all of that. It's not going to fulfill that hole inside you. But what about people who aren't getting many of their basic needs met, or it's a constant daily struggle? Do you see that as some kind of spiritual deficiency, or is that a different issue altogether?
No, I think that's a different issue. We're not talking about people who don't have enough money to eat or don't have enough money for shelter. So, you know, that is a big problem. But those are not the problems that I'm addressing in Lost and Found. And they are not the problems that I was addressing in my 8 books about food or my 7 books about food. That's another dimension of problem that needs to be addressed, but I'm not addressing that. I'm addressing the compulsion. I'm addressing addictions. I'm addressing how we use substances to alter our consciousness. I'm not addressing the problem, the cultural problem of economics and how the class system needs to be fixed. I'm not even pretending to know about that or to go there.
Okay. Well, how do you suggest, how do we change our relationship with money or food or whatever external thing that it is we're using? How do we get beyond that compulsion?
I think the first thing is to become interested in what you're doing. I don't think it helps to be given a list of how-tos, because we all have many lists of those. We are inundated with lists of what to do and how to do it. I think the initial quandary that many of us have, particularly around money, but also around food, is that we want it to be fixed, but we're actually not interested in it. We're not interested in ourselves very much. I found that out when we lost every cent we had, that I was living with low level of anxiety, and it turns out another interviewer quoted this statistic to me last week that 75% of the people in this country are ongoingly, if that's a word, anxious about their relationship with money. So I was living with low-level anxiety day to day to day, but I wasn't particularly interested in what my beliefs and thoughts were about money. I wasn't interested. And for me, during the 17 years I was dieting and binging and losing and gaining 1,000 pounds during that time, it never occurred to me to be interested in what I was using food to express, to actually put myself at the center of my inquiry. I just wanted to find the right diet or the right food or the right program to follow so I could fix what was wrong. But I wasn't interested, number one, in the discomfort itself, in what in me felt as if I needed to be using food. Why was I eating when I wasn't hungry? Why was I making myself so uncomfortable with food? It didn't make sense. But I wasn't interested in that. I just wanted to be fixed. And as I said, the same is true with money. I wasn't particularly interested in why I was putting all of my money in one place and what I believed about myself and money and about worth and about value and about sufficiency that prompted me to do that. So the first answer to that question really is that there's, rather than looking for a list of how-tos, the first step in is to become interested in why you're not interested.
Well, Janine, how do you feel about taking questions from the audience?
I'm fine taking one or two.
All right. Well, I'm going to put that number out there. If you'd like to get on the air and ask Janine a question, the number is 347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. And Janine, I'm really curious. It was interesting. The book is wonderful, and it's just so illuminating about how our relationship to money is. We just don't really think about why we do the things that we do. It's almost just like pre-programmed habitually, just this dysfunctional behavior. And one of your retreat students, it was interesting how she said that she doesn't eat doesn't eat much when she doesn't have a lot of money, and then when she has money, she goes out to restaurants and spends it on unhealthy foods and kind of binges and splurges at the same time. And I mean, I would think that if you when you do have money, that would be the time that you'd be buying the most nutritious food and shopping at the organic market, and rather than doing what she was doing. So why do you think people do that kind of thing?
I think we have patterns with food and with money. And again, I don't think it has to do with food or with money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that both, if you think about both as giant stages upon which we act out our basic beliefs about being alive. And we can act out these beliefs because we're all walking transmitters of our beliefs, the way we think, the way we act, our relationships with people, with our kids, with our partners, with our colleagues, with food, with money, with the internet. You know, it's all about what we feel and believe to be true. We're always acting that out. And so that's my main answer to that. You can tell, you're making statements basically all the time about what you believe about your own value, about worth, about abundance, about scarcity, about joy, about pleasure in your relationship to food. So if I take a huge helping of mashed potatoes when I'm not really hungry, and this is often what happens at my retreats, because at my retreats we do hands-on work with food. We eat together a couple of times every day, and we pay a lot of attention and use a lot of consciousness with the eating that we do, and with what we put on our plates and why we put it on our plates. And so if a student takes a big helping of, let's say, mashed potatoes, and she's not really hungry for all those mashed potatoes, and none of us are hungry for that amount of mashed potatoes. But if we look, then we see, okay, well, I'm feeling like I need comfort, so I'm feeling empty. I don't know how to be with this emptiness. I'm afraid that I can't be with this. I'm afraid that if I start touching it, it will consume me. There'll never be an end, I'll fall apart, whatever those beliefs are. And so I'm going to use what I have right in front of me, which is these mashed potatoes, because they're fluffy, they taste good, they're soft, and they bring me instantaneous comfort. And they are better than not having any comfort at all.
Mm.
And so that would be... And then what I would do if I was working with somebody is say, and is that true? Let's look and see. Number one, do you feel empty? Where is that emptiness? Is it really true that if you felt that emptiness, you would fragment, you would fall apart? We don't even realize that, as one of my teachers says, we're following instructions given to us 10 or 20 or 40 or 50 years ago by people we wouldn't ask for street directions from today. And part of those instructions are, don't feel your feelings, shape up, have a cookie when you're sad, you know, whatever it is. People don't like it when you feel X, Y, and Z, so put a lid on it. And so I'm interested in the messages that we're always transmitting, what they say about how we feel, and questioning some fundamental assumptions and convictions upon which we live our lives, that the whole rest of our lives are built.
Beautifully said. And DW919 in the chat room brought up a really interesting point, that people often use food or money as a way of controlling if they feel out of control.
Yes. The only problem is that often what happens with both is that we can feel out of control about something, then we eat, and then we feel out of control about the food or about the money we've spent and our credit card debt. And what happens is that if we feel out of control about a feeling or about emptiness or about fear or about loneliness, there isn't so clear a sense about how to work with that if you're not used to working with that, if you're not intimate with yourself in that way, if you don't have a kind, friendly attitude or relationship with yourself and with discomfort itself, that can feel out of control. And so what we will then do is do something like eat or spend so that we can then feel out of control about something that we actually can control. Because nobody else is putting the food into your mouth, whereas a feeling seems to come from nowhere and seems as if it is out of control.
Very interesting. And Janine, in reading your book, there was a lot of discussion about where these beliefs about yourself came from in very early childhood. And you came to a realization, I believe that Bernie and Ruth, his wife's name was Ruth, those are the names of your parents.
Right. I said it was sort of like having Bonnie and Clyde for parents in the nomenclature department. I think that was just a huge coincidence, if you believe in coincidences.
So where, let's talk a little bit about your childhood and how you saw your parents interacting where it came to finances.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
How when you were a kid, what are some of the things that you noticed your parents doing around finances that started to give you those beliefs about yourself and what your level of worth was?
And, you know, this is a great question because I think what most of us don't realize is that we have laminated those beliefs about money that we picked up from the situations in our childhood. And usually there's conflicts about money because, again, I want to say that even when there is enough, money is a way that we communicate feelings and beliefs about worth and value, who gets to have, who doesn't get to have, what you deserve, what you don't deserve, having enough. It's fraught. I mean, because it's something that we need for our survival, it gets hooked into that survival mechanism, and then all of these other things get laminated onto it. So it's complicated. Or I shouldn't say complicated, but I should say it's charged. And I think if you know that, then it becomes easier to look at because you're dealing with something that's charged, and you're able to say what's happening here. So for me, money was used for love. Money was used as a substitute for contact. I saw my parents fighting about money all the time. My father was the one who made it. My mother apparently was the one who spent it. These are gender division lines. And my mother was always trying to get more and always feeling as if my father was going to take it away. So there never felt like there was enough, even though there was. There was always a feeling like the will was going to run dry tomorrow. And so you had to store for the loss that was just about to come, the catastrophe that was imminent. And I write a lot about that in all of my books, a sort of catastrophe is imminent frame of mind, which is not really hard to find in our culture, particularly now with all of this information about 2012 and the world coming to an end and the biblical weather disasters that are happening. Catastrophe is imminent frame of mind has been with us for a very long time, and you can hook into that easily around money.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious. It was interesting how you saw your mother having, or you'd asked your mother as an adult after you lost your money, that she had when your family had enough money, she had a wallet full of credit cards. So she was able to freely spend if she wanted or needed to, but then at the end of the month when the bills came and your father had to pay the bills, that was when she had to justify or apologize, or that was when there was a discussion about what she was buying and her worth, correct?
Right. But I think that's true for many, many women that I've talked to. I can't tell you the amount of women I've talked to who hide their purchases from their partners. And it's not just about the credit card bills coming due. It's about some kind of secrecy and shame about being allowed to have what you have.
Now, is that the same kind of concept as people, because there are many people, we started off the hour talking about how people don't really like to discuss money. They don't want to divulge how much money they make in a year. If it's considered extremely rude if you ask someone how much money they make.
Yes, and what's interesting is that people would rather talk about how many times a week they have sex than how much money they make. And I wonder why that's true. I don't know the answer to that. It's a cultural taboo. I feel it too. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but that is the way that it is. That's part of the secrecy and shame that I'm talking about with money. And this cloak around it, not supposed to talk about it. And see, the thing is, it goes even further than that. If I'm not supposed to talk about it, really, I'm not supposed to think about it. I'm not supposed to be conscious about it. How do you ever deal with these issues there if you can't talk about it and be conscious about it?
It's almost the same as it would be rude to ask, well, at least a woman, it's rude to ask her how much she weighs.
Yes, that's right. Although, you know, I talk about this very often with my students, that there seems to be what I call, or actually not what I call, but one of my students called a club called the Whiners and Diners. She called it the Whiners and Diners. So there's a way that we get together around our wounds, in a way, and that we bond, and it becomes difficult to break free from the obsession if the way that we bond together is through the obsession itself. Because then you feel like if I break free from it, then I'll lose love. That's not exactly what you're talking about, but I wanted to point that out because that's one of the challenges of breaking free from the obsession. It's one of the challenges of having enough, of feeling good about yourself, is that many people connect around not feeling good.
So it's a perfect example, like when people lose a lot of weight, or they either get a new job where they're making a lot more money, or they lose their job where they're making much less money, the relationships around them tend to break up, at least those more like acquaintance, not really tight relationships, they kind of fade away.
Well, they do. The relationships that are only based on your suffering to be in them, those are the ones that will dissolve. And I think we don't realize in our lives how many relationships we have, or if we have any, that are based on us being uncomfortable in and with ourselves and bonding around that discomfort, lamenting, complaining about that until we start working ourselves through that and out of that. And then we can see, oh, is it that I don't have anything to say now? What happens to congregating around the water fountain, so to speak, about the latest diet or the splurge that we just did this week on something we didn't actually need.
And so do you think now about the things that we don't actually need, whether it's fast food or the latest cell phone or car or whatever, for me, it's a chicken or egg kind of question. Do you think that the media contributes to this, or if the media is causing the problem, or if perhaps maybe they're just exploiting an issue that was always there?
You know, I actually am not an expert in this, so I wouldn't begin to be able to answer that. I know that it's a circle, that our insatiable hunger for things and our resistance to looking inside, and really the lack of models we have of people who do that, even though there are more and more and more teachers around who are lighting the way. But that hunger for things as a way to fix a discomfort inside of ourselves, or the distance we feel inside ourselves from ourselves, and that causes discomfort. When we're not actually feeling that we're being true, that we are living expressions of who we are, then there's discomfort. There's a distance between who we are and what we feel, who we are and what we're doing. And to the degree that there's distance, I believe is the degree that we feel uncomfortable. And because many of us don't know what to do with that discomfort, we look for external solutions. And the media is part of that. But the media is fed by us. So it is a circle.
Thank you for answering that. And we have a caller on the air right now, so I'm going to bring them up from area code 713. Hi, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I haven't read the book, obviously, but I've been listening with interest. And I was wondering if any of the basic kind of teachings about just basic budgeting, I mean, things that anybody could know or already knows about ordering one's sort of financial life, depending on the personality needs and issues of the person, if those basic things could in fact be a technique for demystifying money and defusing its power a little bit.
So my answer to that would be yes and no, and I'll tell you why. I think that having some kind of approach with money is wise, is sensible. The problem is that because our relationship with money is so emotionally driven, and because there's so much of it that is unconscious, that unless we're also aware of those and that requires being conscious about what we're unconscious about, but that's possible, then any budget in the world will go out the window when something comes up that feels more important than something we've decided on when we were being rational. Because those emotional urges are based in survival, and they're also based in, I can't feel this no matter what. It will kill me if I feel this. And no matter what we've decided about how much money we're going to spend or not spend, there is a tendency for those wise decisions to go flying out the window when the unconsciousness comes up. So that's why I mean that my answer is yes and no.
Right, I can see that. And that's why I wondered, just depending on how exactly a person is using money to either, medicating their stress or solving their inner issues or whatever is going on. I guess the severity of that would indicate whether or not one could make a shift. But I was just, witness to the fact in my own life and in other people's lives that some of the games that mental games and emotional games that people play with money can actually be swapped out for a new game, a game of reducing debt and then saving for things needed and budgeting month to month. In other words, it's a new gimmick and it's a new form of control. It's just involved enough to keep one interested, and with a little success, such as reducing the debt and building wealth and all of those different, you know, things that are sort of the payoffs for order, for viewing money as a tool rather than as a sort of a powerful thing that we serve. I don't know. I just have witnessed how, for those who can make the shift, it's a decent swap. It much kind of controls us in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean,
I don't
work that way. I don't switch one game for another game. I mean, the only thing that I really talk about is consciousness, becoming aware of what you're doing and having what you do come from that. If that works for you, I think it's great. Whatever works. That's not the way that I work, and that's not what I teach.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, caller. I really appreciate that. And Janine, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about just the initial reactions when you first found out the money's gone. I mean, I can imagine it was an incredible shock. So what did you go through with your thought process and your emotions in those first few days?
Well, I wrote all about that in Lost and Found, and
mm-hmm.
It was an unfolding. It was getting the nightmare call that nobody wants to get, and I certainly went through terror and blame, a huge amount of self-blame and regret, shame. And then I realized that in order to live through the night, in order just to make it day to day, I had to, and I realized this from having support from my very dear friends and my teachers as well, that I needed to begin focusing on what I hadn't lost, not what I had lost. From two of my teachers said to me, nothing of any value is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shocking to hear that. And they both said that to me on the day I found out that my husband and I lost 30 years of life savings. And yet this was coming from two people that I trusted and loved and I knew were telling the truth. And so I began focusing on and being vigilant about focusing on what I still had left, which was everything, really. It was nothing in terms of finances, but it was everything in terms of awareness, in terms of my capacity to breathe and see and move and feel and love, and the fact that I still had a roof over my head for that night. I had a lot of sardines in my cabinet, and so I ate a lot of sardines and hard-boiled eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a matter of taking my meditation practice into everyday life, moment to moment, and the urgency of doing that. And because the consequences of not doing that were so dire, which really are that I went spiraling into terror and blame and regret, I was able to do that. And that allowed me to have a ground of within a very short time of fundamental goodness and sanity. And from there, I could make objective decisions about what to do.
It's interesting because what you say about your meditation practice, and you may have mentioned this in the book, but how having that meditation practice in advance, if it's too late to start when you're sick or you're broke or, well, I'm not saying it's ever too late, but I mean, the time to prepare yourself and to start practicing is now, as opposed to trying to rely on that and scramble when things don't go your way. How important is it in what you teach to really practice that meditation? Like, are you doing that to prepare for when things go awry, or what is your feeling about meditation and why you've been practicing it?
Well, meditation means different things for different people, and I don't think it's I don't think it works very well to use it to prepare for catastrophe, because unless there is a love for it in the moment, then what's the point, really? I have never found that kind of urgency and nervous system agitation, even when it comes to being the reason that I meditate, lasts long. It's sort of like losing weight to get to a wedding in 2 months. It doesn't work. It's not a good enough reason to do it, and it doesn't lead to long-lasting change. In terms of, and I've done it because of that. Believe me, I've done it. When I first became interested in meditation, it was the early 70s. And I didn't become interested because of disaster or catastrophe. I became interested, I think, as so many people did in the 70s, and maybe some people who are listening now weren't even born in the 70s, but I was. And I read Ram Dass's book, and I read a book called Grist for the Mill, and I really understood when I read that another way of being was possible for me, that there was a difference between who I took myself to be based on my history and who I actually was. And I felt a palpable sense of that when I read that book, and I got a taste that living that way was possible. And I, at that point, was willing to do anything to live that way. And so I sort of made a decision then to do whatever it took to devote my life to that, because I knew, or I felt, I mean, I didn't know. I was 20 years old, and I felt that that's what a true life was. So I've gone through different relationships with meditation over the last 40 years. And I, you know, there have been moments where it's been a should and I have to, and, you know, I've done a lot of different kinds of meditation. I've done straight Buddhist and Vipassana meditation. I've done the Goenka meditation of clearing. I've done Sufi meditation and Tibetan Buddhist meditation and Advaita and just being meditation. And, you know, I've just been through the rounds with meditation, and I finally have come to that the reason to do it is to be it. Not to do it, but to actually be that. And that if you love that, then you do it. You end up doing what you love. And I think what we're talking about with obsession is that, and I didn't say this, is that people eat and the way they spend money. And I wrote about this a lot in Women, Food, and God, my book previous to Lost and Found. And I talk about this a lot on the online retreat, which I'm teaching now, which I haven't mentioned, which I adore as a form of teaching, a week-by-week online retreat. It's every week live with me for an hour and a half, wherever you are, no matter where you are in the world, people can listen to it or download it and have lifetime listening to it. And it's a fabulous way of getting the teachings out And that's in the process of happening right now. And I would urge anybody who wants to sort of be part of a live online community where the teaching is palpable to come and join us and me.
Where's your website?
It's just my website, JeneneRoth.com, JeneneRoth.com. And all this information is on my website. But what I have discovered, to bring it back, because this is sort of a full circle answer, is that loving the stillness and loving just being is why I love meditating and sitting and also understanding that my relationship to my own thoughts and my relationship to my feelings is sort of a fundamental relationship, because in the end, it's you and your mind. It's you and what's going on in your mind and how you work with it and how you see it. And it's, you know, we all get old and sick and die, and we're sort of just left with that. It's no longer about our bodies or about our money or about anything else. It's about who we are and who we take ourselves to be and how we defend ourselves from the truth or not. And so I think that meditation, however you describe it, and whatever that means to you, Rumi called it an appointment with myself. So having an appointment with yourself every day so that you can remember what's important and come back to yourself again and again. Because, you know, it's great to do that every day as a touchstone, but then you have the rest of the day. And I think what meditation at its best can teach you is how to live that, not just do it for a half an hour twice a day, but how to do that in every moment of your life, how to come back, how to return again and again and again and again to what's true and what's real.
So beautifully said, Jeneen. Thank you. And we just have a few minutes left in the show. The name of the book is Lost and Found, Unexpected Revelations About Food and Money. And you can find Jeneen online at JeneneRoth.com. So, Jeneen, what is the one or two things, what is the main thing that you are hoping that readers will take with them from your book, Lost and Found?
I would say that it's the same thing that I've been saying about the relationship with food, and that your relationships to money and food are exact expressions of your beliefs about worth and value, about abundance, joy, peace, pleasure. And unless you question your beliefs, your behavior will remain the same. And then unless you change your behavior, your life will remain the same. But it's kindness and curiosity and love and questioning what you've never dared to question that is involved here. I think the kindness part is very important, because force and fear and deprivation and guilt and judgment and blame and shame will not ever, not once, lead to long-lasting change.
Wonderfully said. And is there anything that you would like to add before we wrap up the hour?
I would say for people to also pay attention. I'd say two things. Allow yourself to have what you already have. Remember that enough isn't a quantity. I've had people say to me while eating, somebody, a man in a workshop years ago, we were eating a piece of chocolate together, the whole workshop, and he said, I've eaten bags and bags of these, but I've never eaten just one. And when you allow yourself to have the one that you have in your mouth or in your closet or on your desk, the whatever it is that you have, then your relationship to yourself changes. So most of us don't allow ourselves to have what we have. We don't take it in. We don't let ourselves be filled by that. And so we're always wanting more. That's one thing. And a corollary to that is to pay attention daily to what cannot be measured or counted. Notice how you feel in nature, how you feel with people you love, and cultivate appreciation and kindness. And do this many, many times a day. And when you think you've reached the end, begin again.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much, Janine, for your book and for being on the show today. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Janine. Have a good day. So that was Janine Ross, again, author of Lost and Found, Unexpected Revelations About Food and Money. And if you're interested in taking her online workshop and more information about her other books as well, go to her website, JanineRoss.com. And so as promised earlier at the start of the hour, I'm going to play a song by Surya. And if you do like her music, I would encourage you to go to iTunes and look up Songs of the Buddha, and you can hear little clips and samples of the songs to make sure you like them, because all the proceeds from that, the sale of that album, is going to go to charities that support Tibet, and the money is going to go directly to Tibet. It's not going to be through any kind of agency. She has a direct connection to a monastery in Quebec, or in Tibet, rather. So again, the name of the album is Songs of the Buddha. And here is Surya with, let's play the grateful song so we can focus on being thankful for the things that we do have in our lives right now in this moment, rather than always striving for more, not accepting and really experiencing the life that we have now instead of, you know, focusing on what we want down the road. So here is the grateful song, and I'm going to send you love and blessings, and namaste.
With everybody searching just like me, it's easy to see how life is filled with impossibility. Running from fate, looking for an escape is oh so easy. Look around and that is she. I am thankful for existence today, and I'm grateful for where my life is at in this moment. Oh, for all the things I have, I would like to say that I am grateful. For today, I am grateful for today. give honor to yourself by seeing God in everyone and everything. When spring comes to line our streets with leaves, it's the same miracle as within a womb a little baby sleeps. And the secrets within our hearts we keep can shape our world with both virtue and deceit. Oh, set them free. Set them free. Set them free.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.